From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, just as the criminal trial for the disgraced mogul Harvey Weinstein got underway in New York, new charges were filed against him here in Los Angeles. And we'll find out why cast members of the original L Word were so passionate about rebooting the show with an updated perspective.
Through the years, we just were like, no one's come along to fill our shoes. So it frustrated us. And we thought, you know what? Queer people need to be represented on television, and it's our job to bring the show back.
Plus, a look at the life and legacy of one of America's foremost conceptual artists. All that coming up on The Frame. More than 2 years after the Harvey Weinstein story first broke, the former film producer and studio chief entered a New York courtroom today to face charges of rape and sexual assault. But just as court was adjourned on the East Coast, new charges were filed against Weinstein here in Los Angeles.
LA County prosecutors are filing criminal charges against Harvey Weinstein. The district attorney is just
charges against Harvey Weinstein of assaulting and raping two women in incidents that occurred nearly 7 years ago at hotels.
Dominic Patton, a senior editor at Deadline, is covering the Weinstein trial in New York, and he explained what happened today in Manhattan.
Everyone has talked about the trial starting. It's kind of like how people have been talking about the new decade starting. It's not really. The math is this was dealing with the pretrial motions, of which there were many. One of which was expected that Judge James Burke did not rule on was whether or not he was going to allow cameras in the courtroom. That's looking more and more unlikely now, though it still could happen. What was talked about was a number of issues around requests to sequester the jury, which the judge rejected, basically a gag order on the lawyers from the prosecution, which the judge rejected. There was talk about how we're going to deal with incidents from other jurisdictions, if that is to occur or not. There was also discussions about how we're going to deal with this incredible process of picking a jury. Harvey Weinstein's lawyers, his latest round of lawyers, I should say, have insisted for the past several months that there is no way he can receive a fair trial in the media-centric environment of New York City. They've actually unsuccessfully tried on two occasions to have the case moved out of Manhattan. Over 2,000 jury summons have been sent out vis-a-vis this case. To give you a sense of what that means, for a regular case, usually about 200 are sent out, and that's topping it for most of these. So clearly, there is a sense of getting a large pool of which to draw from. Over the next few days, what we're going to see here in New York City is these pre-jury selections, where they're just going to try to start skimming off stuff as they go through batches of 150 at a time in front of the lawyers. Then next week, on about January 14th, they're going to get two actual jury selection. And if that moves along somewhat faster, probably somewhere around the 21st of January, they're actually going to get to the actual trial, if there's no hiccups.
More than 80 women have gone public with claims that Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulted or harassed them. But this is a much narrower case. There are only two women involved here, and we don't know the identity of one of them. What are the charges that Harvey Weinstein is facing in New York?
Well, what he's facing is essentially five felony charges. And those charges, which have gone through various stages since he was first arrested in May 2018, with new indictments coming in, and one woman was dropped from the case. Now what Harvey Weinstein is looking at is essentially life in prison if he is found guilty on these charges. But these are very, very complex. In the court of public opinion, a lot of people have already condemned Harvey Weinstein. Clearly, there are dozens and dozens of women reporting assaults and harassment by him. And just like with Bill Cosby and many others in these situations, the MOs seem to be eerily repetitive. So people make their own decisions. But in actual court, these things are quite hard to prove. They have got to show that these were non-consensual relationships, which Harvey Weinstein always insists they were. They might have been messy. He definitely has admitted he's been unfaithful to his now divorced wife, but they were consensual. And there are, part of the defense's strategy is to show that there were back and forth and relationships, and even sometimes quite warm and what seemed to be, at least through text messages and emails, intimate conversations between these women and Harvey Weinstein. It's going to be very hard, believe it or not, for the prosecution to get a guilty. However, and again, I mentioned Bill Cosby. In the first trial, Bill Cosby ended in a mistrial. The second trial of Bill Cosby, what happened was the judge allowed what are called prior bad act testimonies that were other women outside of Andrea Constance, who was the woman in the Bill Cosby case, other women who had reported being assaulted by Bill Cosby to testify. The judge in this case, Justice James Burke of the New York Supreme Court here in New York City, is now allowing this to happen, including a former actress from The Sopranos who's going to give her account of what happened. That could prove the tipping point, as happened with Bill Cosby.
So we know what happened, even though it was brief, inside the New York courtroom today. Back in Los Angeles, L.A. County District Attorney Jackie Lacey announced that Weinstein has been charged with raping one woman and sexually assaulting another. What was happening outside the courtroom on the steps of the courthouse or in the streets in New York today?
What we saw outside on a very chilly New York morning for you people on the West Coast is we saw individuals like Rosanna Arquette, Rose McGowan, and other women who have alleged that they were assaulted by Harvey Weinstein taking to the street and simply saying, "Time's up," as is the name of the organization that has come to represent many women who have been sexually assaulted and harassed. "Time's up on this kind of behavior on individuals like Harvey Weinstein." They were very direct. Weinstein himself was jeered and heckled by people as he entered the courtroom on a walker earlier today. So very much you're seeing there is explosions happening inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom.
So as we mentioned, the L.A. district attorney filed charges against Harvey Weinstein today, even as he was almost leaving court in New York. How might those two cases affect one another?
Well, this has been a big thing even before L.A. DA Jackie Lacey made her announcement of these charges today, because a lot of times Weinstein has been trying to either halt, pause, or kill civil cases that have been going on against him, like the one that Ashley Judd has going on, which is on halt right now, with his lawyer simply saying he can't be in all these places at once and we have to concentrate on this criminal trial. This issue of other jurisdictions actually came up in court today, and Judge James Burke kind of pushed away from it. Now it's going to come much more to the fore. This could really change the focus of this. Remember, Jackie Lacey is looking at putting Harvey Weinstein away for 28 years over on the West Coast. They have to arraign him. They have to do a bail for him. There's a whole process that has to happen. Suddenly you almost have competing cases, and that could work in Weinstein's favor, even though DAs on both coasts are trying to do justice as they see fit.
Dominic Patton is a senior editor at Deadline. He is in New York covering the trial of Harvey Weinstein. Dominic, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And you can hear more about the charges announced today in Los Angeles against Harvey Weinstein during KPCC's newscast. Next on The Frame, the L Word makes a comeback with a new generation in mind. When the original L Word premiered on Showtime in 2004, it was the first and only TV show entirely about the lives of lesbians. 15 years later, the show's reboot, The L Word Generation Q, is still the only such series. The new show, set 10 years later than the first L Word, features some of the original characters, but it also introduces a younger, more diverse group of queer and trans characters and stories. Cast members and executive producers Kate Manning and Leisha Haley told me they wanted to revive the show with an updated perspective, but even with Marja Lewis Ryan replacing Eileen Chaykin as lead producer, the show keeps true to the original. As Leisha Haley relayed, the new series started with an intimate lesbian sex scene.
Okay, oh, really? My dad came to see the premiere with me the other night, and he was sitting next to me. He loves popcorn, and he had his popcorn. And the opening shot happened, and I'm not going to give anything away, but he leaned over and he goes, "Well, that was alarming." So.
And it feels really intentional that this is the show we're going to have and get used to it and love it or hate it, but this is what we are.
Yep.
Yep.
I agree.
That was the point. I don't think it was something that was overlooked or accidental.
No, not at all. That was the full intention.
Yeah, it's before the title card. It's before the...
Yeah,
like,
it was very intentional.
Yes.
When you think about returning to the show, what was important and what did the show need to have that made it attractive to both of you as actors? Did you feel that there were stories left to be told? What was the motivation of coming back?
Well, we made it come back. I mean, this has been a goal and a project of Kate, myself, and Jennifer Beals, and Eileen, the original creator, for about, what?
8 years,
eight
9 years.
We've been trying to bring it back because a couple of things. We thought it ended prematurely. No one, including Eileen, was very proud of the last season. And when we ended, gay marriage wasn't even legal. So as the years went on and the world was changing and opening up, we just felt someone else was going to come along and fill that void. Like, obviously, someone else is going to do this now. Like, there's going to be another lesbian show. And there was Orange is the New Black, which we're fans of, and now there's a lot more gay content out there. But, you know, through the years, we just were like, no one's come along to fill our shoes. So it frustrated us, and we thought, you know what? Queer people need to be represented on television, and it's our job to bring the show back.
And we couldn't figure out initially what that looked like, because when we talked about this many years ago, reboots didn't exist.
Mm-mm.
We thought, oh, well, maybe it would be a film, but what would that look like? And then slowly but surely, all of these other shows started doing reboots.
Mm-hmm.
So it was giving us at least something to work towards.
Right.
And have an idea of what that would be. And just to fill in the blanks and tell not only the three of us what happened to the three of us, but then also show where the world is now.
I think one of you said that you weren't totally happy with how the series ended. Did you feel in some ways that returning to the L Word, you could maybe correct something that you think you didn't get right?
No. No, it wasn't about the course correction. Just that last season itself was kind of a mess. Everyone knew it. Like Alicia said, even Eileen admits it now. It's no big secret. We weren't trying to course correct anything. We knew there were flaws in the original show, no question. And, you know, and it's been pointed out many times over. And some of the flaws, you know, it was in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody had the vocabulary that we have now or the knowledge. And I think that gets overlooked very often. And it's very easy to see in hindsight.
I want to play a clip where there is what I'll call network brass that have some thoughts about what Alice should do with her show. So let's listen to the scene.
When we bought your podcast, we bought a brand. A poppy, fun, palatable lesbian brand. We want to build off that.
I do, too. I really do. It's just I'm a very curious person, and I think my audience is too, and I just want to give them a little credit. You know, I think we have a real opportunity to make an impact.
And we will always be completely open to your ideas. But we got to stay true to our season one audience, right?
But they might be interested in something more substantial.
It's unlikely.
Could you talk to me about why that scene is so important, about what it has to say, not just about this character, but about what's going on in popular culture and the watering down?
Well, you know, it's hard because I don't want to say that that our new showrunner is writing her experience directly, because we do have the most incredible network that we work with, Showtime. But I think that through her past, maybe she's dealt with networks that aren't that great. And when you try to have queer content, edgy, feminist-driven content on television, it's not always people's favorite subject. And people want things. I mean, my character back in the day was on a similar show to The View. And they were like, you know, be fun gay. And I was trying to talk about deeper subjects. And so, you know, I think people don't always want to talk about the hard stuff, and television can be fluffy. And that's basically what my character is going through. Is the network bought her podcast called The Chart. And she talked about everything she loved and wanted to talk about. And once they bought her, they're like, nope, now be fun gay.
We're talking with Kate Minnig and Leisha Haley about the return of the L Word. There's a segment in an episode where Megan Rapinoe, who I will say just won the Golden Boot as the world's best female soccer player, comes on and she's asked about coming out. But I'm wondering, in the context of the show, do you think that there are ways that people who might be closeted, who are thinking about coming out, can look at the L Word either now or in its previous iteration and have the courage somehow through the show to be open about who they are?
I mean, I hope to God that is the case. That's one of our goals deep down, that we want queer kids to have representation. I personally longed for it when I was a kid. I didn't have any, and that would have changed the entire course of my life if I saw someone on TV or in the movies that looked like me, talked like me, felt like me. Because when you see yourself represented, in a positive way, and that's what I also love about our show. We have women that are in powerful positions, that are doing well financially, that have a chosen family, who are surrounded by friends, a community that loves them, a world that loves them. And I think when that's reflected, it helps people. And that's kind of a deep way to look at our show, but
Well, the original had that too.
Yeah.
I mean, people still to this day come up and say how much that show meant to them because it helped them realize who they were. And what a beautiful, powerful message that is. Entertainment was able to not just entertain, but to help someone feel good about themselves.
Kate, I want to play a scene where your character is thinking about opening a lesbian bar.
This used to be a gay bar, though, right?
Yeah. Years ago.
Damn, times have changed.
Now, Tessa's always trying to buy out the owners, turn it back to what it used to be.
She should.
Yeah. What we could do is just rip TVs out, switch the menu up, and clean the place up. You know, it would be the only lesbian bar in the city. Only one.
Well, then someone should just buy it and you guys run it.
Yeah. Yeah, they should.
No, I'm serious.
Is it actually the case that there are no lesbian bars in LA right now?
Apparently so. Yeah, I guess
they throw nights.
They have pop-up things.
Yeah, pop-up
events. I wouldn't know. I don't go out that much, but it's certainly not the way it used to be. A lot of the original spots in LA have shut down. So
the Palms,
the Normandy Room,
Oxwood Inn, they're all gone.
Oxwood's gone?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right. Things are serious. Yeah, we need places to
go. So I think that was the whole point of that.
But also there are other points that even though we have progressed in some ways, that there are still issues that the characters and society are wrestling with. There's a conversation about the church and about whether or not a church can be inclusive and whether or not it can embrace marriage equality. So it does feel like even as the show is celebrating how far we have come, there is still a long way to go.
There is. And I think something we've all talked about is that, you know, a lot of terminology has changed, but in a lot of ways, the world is still the same in some regards. And we've progressed certainly from the last 10 years, but...
But we can't sit comfortably and go, well, we've
arrived.
Well,
we fixed it. We fixed it all. And there still is a lot of work to be done still, for sure.
Yeah. And hopefully other shows will follow in the footsteps of this show.
And there are shows that are helping, you know, carry on the message and whatnot. Like, we have Pose.
Yeah.
What an incredible show.
Love it.
And I know that has reached a broad audience and how incredible. And then there was Transparent and, like Leisha said, Orange is the New Black. So there are
The Politician.
And The Politician.
Yeah.
I also want to ask you about the people who are making the show, the writers and the directors. I saw the second episode was directed by a friend of mine, Allison Liddy Brown, who is a lesbian director. It feels like probably very specifically, there are a lot of women and probably a lot of gay women who are making this show. And how does that start to affect not only the stories that are being told, but also the feeling on set and the community that creates?
It's everything. I mean, it's been most important for us to be surrounded by the queer community, the trans community, I mean, the production office.
And to give
everyone a chance and a role.
That maybe haven't had one in the past.
Exactly.
Is to give them a space to work and show what they've got.
Yeah. Our crew is so diverse. You know, we're proud of that.
I want to ask you one last thing. The show is obviously, from the very beginning, very sex positive. How do you make sure that in a show that is going to be very candid about women having sex together, that you create a safe place for the actors who are doing those scenes?
Well, now there's something that shows have intimacy coordinators that we discovered. Back in the day, we were our own intimacy coordinator. But now there's someone that actually comes to set, speaks to you beforehand to make sure you're okay with what the scene entails. And you're like, yeah, I'm fine. We're good.
Right.
Like, because we have this very safe environment and we're very fortunate to have everyone, like, have a group of people that look out for us. It feels like overkill, but it's also just like this added protection. But it's such a welcoming group of people. We've been very, very fortunate.
Kate Manning and Leisha Haley are executive producers and co-stars of The L Word, Generation Q. Kate and Leisha, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Thanks,
thank you.
That was fun.
The L Word Generation Q airs Sunday nights on Showtime. Up next on The Frame, the legacy of artist John Baldessari. What makes art art? That's the question John Baldessari tried to answer with his work. The Southern California native was a conceptual art pioneer and a huge influence on generations of artists. He passed away last week at the age of 88. LA Times art critic Christopher Knight joined us to talk about Baldessari's lasting impact on the art world.
John, of course, was one of the quote-unquote founders of the conceptual art movement, which sounds very grand. And John was not a grand person at all. The conceptualism based in his work basically came out of a desire to question the idea of what a work of art is. And he made objects of all kinds, from prints to collaged photographs to paintings on canvas to photographs on canvas. And John was curious to know how art fit within a mass media culture. And so that's what he began to explore.
I want to play a clip from an interview that you did with Baldessari in 2011 at the Hammer Museum, and it's this conversation about what is and is not art and who gets to decide when it becomes art.
If you have, let's say, a hunk of concrete with rebar in it, and you see it's out in the street, it's just a hunk of concrete with rebar in it. Put it in a museum, it's art, it's sculpture. So it's contextual, but if you see a canvas out in the street, it's still art.
And that makes me think about what he was as a teacher. He taught famously at CalArts and at UCLA. What was his legacy as a teacher in terms of how he changed perceptions of what was and was not art?
I think John's legacy as a teacher has been pretty enormous. He always understood that as a teacher, it was not possible for him to instruct someone how to be an artist. But he also understood that what he could do would be to create the conditions within which a student could discover him or herself as being an artist. One of his most famous works is a text piece in which he scrawled on the wall in chalk, "I will not make any more boring art." And he scrawled it over and over and over. It's the kind of thing that a naughty student in elementary school is made to do. So the pedagogical aspect of that work is important. And the pedagogical interest of his own art in terms of creating an environment in which one can see oneself emerge is important.
And just a couple of years ago, John Baldessari went on The Simpsons as a voice actor and performed as himself.
So you've moved into painting giant schnozzes.
Marge, the mouth has had its say. Now it's time to find out what the nose knows.
That's a pull quote if ever I heard one.
Did Baldessari take himself not terribly seriously?
He took himself really seriously by not taking himself seriously. Humor is everywhere in John's work. The more you know about art, the funnier and more wry the work becomes. But I think he understood that one of the great things about a joke is that the response to the joke is instantaneous. You either laugh or you don't laugh. And once you laugh, then you can begin to peel the artichoke and find out, what is it that made you laugh? Why is this funny? But the humor is really important in his work.
I want to ask you about a piece that Baldessari did in the late 60s. It was called Tips for Artists Who Want to Sell. It was a sign, and it had three bullet points. I'll just read the first. Generally speaking, paintings with light colors sell more quickly than paintings with dark colors. And it goes on to describe what should be in those paintings. How did Baldessari see art and the art market? Was he comfortable with the fact that his art was worth something?
He was, I think, vexed by the idea that his art was worth something. What he wanted more than anything was for people to look at his work. But there's one story I want to tell you from 2015, which I think explains a good deal about John, his work, his place within his work. In 2015, he made a multiple sculpture that had its debut in a party at the architect Kulapat Yantra's house. And when you arrived at the house for the presentation of the sculpture, there, hanging over the swimming pool, was an enormous sculpture of a carrot. an orange carrot with a green top. And John was there at the opening party, and I looked at the carrot, and I looked at John, and I thought, this carrot is a self-portrait. The carrot was about 6.5, 7 feet tall. John was 6'7". You always knew when John was in the room because he towered above everyone else. And the carrot kind of embodied what John's art interest was, and that is he saw a work of art as a carrot, not a stick, that whatever influence it had was not to beat you over the head, it was to entice you.
Christopher Knight is the art critic at the Los Angeles Times. Christopher, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Happy to do it.
And that is all for today. But don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.